morning, everybody. Happy New Year. The first meeting in 2011. Probably won't be the last. With our friendly legislature down the road or up the road or whatever you want to call it, I assume we're going to spend a lot of time in Austin over the next few months. But glad to be here. Glad everybody else is here. This meeting's called to order January 26, 2011 at 9:10 a.m. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Smith has a statement to make.
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I would like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll begin with the Ad Hoc Infrastructure Committee this morning. Chairman Duggan, please call your meeting board.
I did not. Normally not caught. Okay, first item of business is to approve the minutes from the March 31st, 2010 meeting. Is there a motion to approve? Motion by Commissioner Dixon, second by Commissioner Calhoun. Any objections to the minutes? All right. Deemed approved. Carter, would you please update us on the progress in implementing the land and water conservation?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First things first, I'm going to pass out basically a scorecard to all of you on how we're doing with respect to meeting kind of the key metrics in the land and water plan. As all of you will recall, we were tasked with kind of 25 measurable items that were quantifiable and that we would seek to accomplish over the course of the plan's duration. We set target dates for their completion. I'm not going to go through this document. I'll let y'all take that with you and read through it. But basically, again, 25 specific metrics, 16 of which were slated to be completed in fiscal year 2010. The remaining nine in 2011. You'll see on this document, I'll call your attention just very quickly to pages 2 and 3, which gives you a tabular format of the specific goal, who's responsible, when it's going to be done, and what its status is. And so you can see, for instance, all of the items that are colored in green are ones that we have completed. Ones that are in orange are ones that either we didn't meet our target or we are still working on them. And we have brief explanations in those tables for them and also more detailed explanations for you in the back. All in all, I think we're making good progress here as we sort through this plan and get a better handle on the metrics associated with these goals. I think we'll be able to let you know just how realistic some of our targets were. But if you see anything after you've had a chance to peruse them that gives you any pause about things that we've either met or not met, please let us know. I also want to let you know that thanks to the work of Maria Araujo, we have a Spanish language version of the land and water plan. And so we're very excited about that development. Maria did an extraordinary job on the translation, had help from others inside the agency, but that was an important element of this as well. So wanted to share that with you. Any questions on that, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, on page 3, where we're a little bit short on hosting families in the outdoor family program, which I think everybody here is so excited about that program. Is that a funding issue? I mean, I know the demand has just been overwhelmed the staff,
You're absolutely right. And in fact, our program team that's working on that felt like that goal was ambitious to start off with. Then we had a couple of other issues. We had some weather-related events that caused us to have to cancel some things. And then we had one big group, I think, that canceled. That is a program where we could certainly benefit from additional funding in order to meet the demand. We just continue to see that explode throughout the state, and we really do have limited capacity to meet that. And so I think the issue is going to be what can we reasonably do with the team that we have now on board, and then also how can we export that program to other partners that can implement it and still get the same thing accomplished, but kind of utilize the key standards that we've set up for it.
Okay, on item 20, the item about the identifying 40 undocumented springs, what do we mean by characterize?
So in that regard, you know, most Texas springs are located on private lands, and historically we really haven't focused or in some cases had access to go in and do physical and chemical and biological characterizations of those springs, what kind of organisms are living in those springs, what's the quantity of flow seasonally, what kind of fluctuations, what's the water chemistry, what's the condition of the riparian areas around those springs. Through the work of Chad Norris and others, we've really pushed on this and made it a priority to get out there and better understand the springs that are so critical in terms of feeding our rivers and creeks. And so that's what we mean by characterization.
And is there any size limitation or size?
No, we're interested in all springs, big and small. You may recall that the kind of the seminal work on springs in Texas was done by a gentleman named Gunnar Brun with the Water Development Board, and he put together a book called The Springs of Texas, in which he documented a number
of great books.
But really, there's been little focused effort to go back and look at those springs and see, are they still flowing? And if so, what's their quality and quantity? And so that's been a priority for us and others on that front.
Anybody else have any?
Back up on the families.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is the 650 an annual goal?
It is. Uh-huh. It's an annual goal.
I mean, do we need to revise it, or are we going to
keep looking at it depending on budget funding?
I think that's right. Let's see how we do next fiscal year, and then I think we ought to keep our goal as is. Let's see how we perform in 2011. If we think it's wildly unrealistic with existing capacity, we'll come back and report that to you and see if you're comfortable with the change goal.
And then on number five, the prescribed fires, establish that acreage figure.
Those acreage figures were really established largely by our Wildlife Division team and our State Parks team, both of which do the vast lion's share of prescribed fire around the state. And so those metrics, you know, reflected what we felt like we could do reasonably on our state wildlife management areas and state parks. And then also the work of our Wildlife Division to get those landowner fire co-ops established in all of the ecoregions. As you know, we always have such a narrow window to get prescribed fires done. And so that constrains us. And, you know, on a day when it's good to be burning, we want to be doing that everywhere, and we can't. And so so we fell short in that regard, again, largely to weather-related issues. I suspect there'll be some years where we will vastly exceed our goals, and there are going to be others in which we don't make it.
Yeah. We're burning quite a bit in the Panhandle right now.
Yeah, good. A lot of burn bans around still that you know are causing landowners a lot of consternation who want to burn.
That was a question I had. Are we constrained by county burn bans?
Well, the way that the state law reads, as I understand it, is that you have to have a certified burn manager in order to be able to get a waiver from a county judge to be able to burn, at which time there's a prescribed burn plan and so or ban. And so we've got to work closely with the county and the commissioner's court to see if we can get exempted to do it safely and responsibly when there's a ban.
Well, people are all certified.
They are, but the state certification was designed really for private landowners and non-governmental employees, so there's a little issue there. I don't know if Ann or Clayton wants to elaborate on that, or do you shed any light? I see everybody looking around behind them for somebody to know what we're talking about.
See, when the burn ban is a private landowner, if you're certified, you got to get the okay from the county.
From the judge.
You can burn. Yeah.
But could a state or could, say, on a wildlife management area, if we want to do a burn, could we hire a private a private, you know, like the Panhandle Burn Association. Yeah. Can we hire a private entity to come in and do it?
Certainly an option.
Yeah.
You know, the on both the Wildlife Division and the State Parks Division, we're using a standard that's set by the National Wildfire Coordinating Group. It's called NWCG is the acronym, and it's really the highest level of prescribed burning standard that exists. And so I'm assuming, and I'm looking at Clayton, are we getting concession and flexibility on that from commissioners' courts to burn? Do you know?
For the record, I'm Clayton Wolf, and I tried my best to stay seated back there. But because Linda Campbell, our program manager, is our lead on this. But my understanding is, in visiting with Ann this just shortly, county commissioners' court are authorized to grant exemptions, but they're not required to. And so we have, our staff tries to establish a good relationship to, I guess, ensure the county that we're going to apply those fires in a prudent manner. And we are granted some exemptions, but my understanding is not in every case and in every county. So we're still trying to build those relationships.
Good answer. Nice, Clay. Any other questions on those? Well, if you have a chance to look at it, don't hesitate to let me know or Scott. Scott is kind of quarterbacking this for us, and so we'll have some of the detail. The last thing that I'll just mention, Mr. Chairman, is a quick update. I think they're going to put a slide up, but it has to do with progress that we're making over at Sheldon Lake. As you will recall, we've launched a major initiative there to help enhance that environmental learning center on site. We forged a partnership with National Audubon to help promote access for youth and conservation education. One of the things in which we've raised a lot of private dollars for over the years, thanks in large part to former Commissioner Al Henry, this project was near and dear to him, is a new observation tower. And so you can see a picture of that. That construction is underway right now, should be completed sometime this spring. It'll be 75 feet. All of the funds, for the most part, are coming from private donation, including the recycled or used oil field pipe to build the tower. And so we're really excited about that, and I think that's going to add a really nice visitor experience to that with, you know, the 5,000 or so kids that come out to that site every year. So look forward to being able to report more to y'all on that after we finish, and hopefully we'll have some kind of ceremony there at Sheldon Lake once we get that completed and cut the ribbon on it. So I think with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude my remarks and turn it back over to you.
Anybody else have any questions or comments? All right. Thank you, Carter. Rich McMonigle, will you present your comments on the capital construction program update, please?
Good morning, Chairman Duggins, Chairman Holt, and Commissioners. My name is Rich McMonigle, and I'm the Director of the Infrastructure Division. This morning, I'll provide you commissioners with a review of our capital construction program in preparation for the current legislative session. And I'll also review two of our projects at the San Jacinto Battleground State Historic Site. On slide 3 are four questions that legislators have asked in the past, and they're questions that legislators, or questions like them, that the legislators will ask in the future. Underlying these questions is a difference in perception between us and some people about different aspects of our capital construction program. And I believe that these differences of perception has caused legislators to have a lack of confidence in our ability to quickly and efficiently spend capital construction funds. And so what I'd like to do is go through each of these questions to kind of describe our perception and the different perceptions that are out there, and as I think that being able to answer these questions will go a long way to gaining the confidence of legislators in our capital construction program. So moving on to the first question in slide number 4, there's no doubt, at least within TPWD, that our backlog of maintenance and repairs is several hundred million dollars. Last year we did a project call and we reviewed projects of totaling $250 million, and those were projects that were just submitted of serious needs. In the past, we tried to put a precise number on that backlog, and usually that number did not stand up to scrutiny. What we were doing was we were spending countless hours tallying the thousands of needs that are in our system, and those needs or those costs were based upon the field estimates of that varied greatly in their experience and expertise in providing those estimates. So we had miscounts, we had double counting, we had inconsistencies, and all of that led to a degree of question of our ability to do this. So the misperception is that people who looked at this number, and there were certainly areas that could be subject to debate, people who looked at that number lost confidence in our ability. They thought, well, if you can't tell us how much your backlog is, maybe we shouldn't be giving you any money. The reality of it is that the way we look at it is we're looking at field estimates that are initial estimates that can range in variance from, you know, factor of two. Therefore, in 2008, TPWD published a state park system study. This study was conducted by two respected firms, Fisher Heck Architects out of San Antonio and Pros Consulting. And the purpose of this study was to define a high-quality state park system. One of the recommendations from that state park study was that we discontinue our efforts to quantify this backlog of deferred maintenance. Instead, what they recommended is that we adopt the industry best practice of investing a percentage of our asset value. That is, rather than just saying these are what our identified projects are, instead we look at an investment. They took a very conservative figure of $808 million of our asset value and used a low percentage of 4% to come up with an estimate of $65 million per biennium is what we need in minor repair and capital repair in just state parks. Now, the study didn't include Fund 9 facilities nor this headquarters. So we have used $32 million as the benchmark to say $32 million is what we need to stay where we are. Anything less than that, that means we're deferring maintenance and it's going to add to the backlog. To put this in perspective, last year we expended $33.5 million in capital construction. So with our current staff and current capabilities and current processes, we're certainly capable of maintaining a pace of $30 million in construction per year. Moving on to slide 5 and our next question. I've put this slides or variations of this up often. This is our generic bond program timeline. Across the top are the six phases of a project and the general times associated with those phases. Below that is a graph of time versus money. So the red line is our expenditure curve that shows how money is expended. The dotted white line is our encumbrance curve, that is how we obligate money to the state when we or obligate the state to pay money when we enter into a contract. A capital construction appropriation has a 5-year lifespan. So the first 9 months after the legislature adjourns, we spend that gaining the approvals of this commission, the Legislative Budget Board, the Texas Public Finance Authority, and the Bond Review Board. Then we spend 6 months in planning, a year in design, and 2 years in construction. As you can tell by the curve, the majority, close to 80% of any project cost is in the construction. You can see we don't get to the construction until the second half of the appropriation. So what the perception is of others is the legislature comes back into session and they look and say, well, you guys haven't done anything. You haven't spent any of that money. When the reality is all of that money is assigned to individual projects. They're just waiting to be encumbered when we get to construction. So I'll stress that over and over again, that what is termed unexpended balances are funds that are actually allocated to individual projects. So that leads us to slide number 6, talking about unexpended balances. There are some who believe that unexpended balances are just money that's sitting around not being used. In fact, they think that the larger the unexpended balance, the more money that's just not being used. And the reality is the opposite, because as I said, all that money is allocated to individual projects. Now, the last time I presented to this commission, I gave a brief history of our recent UBs, and I showed a number of charts breaking it up into its component parts. I won't bore you with that presentation today, but I'll get to the bottom line, which is in our current legislative appropriation request, our estimated capital construction UB is $55,455,554, so we have to give them a precise number on that estimate. What's important to note is that 85% of that money is in two places. Over half of it is tied up in the battleship Texas dry berth, and I'll talk about that project later in my presentation. And then a third of it is in general obligation bonds, which the legislature just gave us last session. So if you remember from my previous slide, all of that, those projects, money's been allocated to each of those projects. They're in design right now, and they're just awaiting construction. So moving on to slide 7, those who believe that UB is just money sitting around not being used, they can't understand if the money is not being used, why do you need more money? Again, across the top is our generic, across the top of this slide is our generic bond program timeline. I've added a legislative timeline with the red arrows. So as has kind of come up already, is that the first biennium of any appropriation is spent in the planning and design. The second biennium is spent in the construction. Now, as we receive appropriation every 2 years, and the appropriation has a 5-year lifespan, you can see that at any one time, we're working with 2 or 3 different appropriations. So during most times, we have one appropriation that's in planning and design, and the appropriation from the previous session is in construction. So if we were to not receive funding from a legislative session, that would mean that there would be no money for design in that coming biennium. But the real impact is not seen for 3 or 4 years later, when we no longer have money for construction. So therefore, construction would come to an end, and we would not have money to continue that construction, and that would become deferred maintenance and add to that backlog. Additionally, without that funding, emergency projects would not be funded. Those are those projects that are emergent health and safety needs that we need to meet immediately, and so therefore we would not have funding of that. As I've said, the money that we have now is allocated to individual projects. Therefore, we need consistent, from session to session, funding in order to initiate new projects to maintain that momentum of the repairs that we have been doing. As such, in our legislative appropriation request, there's an exceptional item requesting $50 million for capital repairs, construction, and development. And of that money, $40 million is designated for statewide capital repairs and $10 million for new development. And so moving to slide 8, I just summarize all of that. Again, 5-year appropriation, life cycle, expenditure curve that has spending at the end results in, naturally, us having a lot of money that waits till the end of that appropriation to be spent. Our estimated UB is $55.4 million. The majority of that is in two areas. As all of our funds are allocated to projects, therefore we need continued funding in order to initiate new projects, and therefore we're asking for $50 million during this session.
Before you move on,
yes.
You go ahead.
Go ahead.
Please.
I thought you were the chairman of this.
I know who the chair of this group is.
Actually, I'm going back on you a little bit. You said you need about 32, 33, and that's what you've been spending. $1 million per year.
Per year, yes, sir.
$65 million per annum, by annum. I'm back on slide 4 for minor and capital repair and state parks. Okay, and I understand there's other needs.
Yes, sir.
So now we move forward. Let me see if I hit the right buttons here to go forward. So now you've got a request in for $50 million for capital repairs, construction, and development. Okay, that's for the biennium, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so that's 50, yeah, so you're actually asking for a little less than, for obvious reasons, both what we were instructed to do relative to submitting to the to our friends at LBB and that group, LAR and all that. Okay. I guess I'm actually thinking to myself, so I'm asking this. I see what you've done, and I'm just trying to figure out how to do it.
Yes, sir. Exactly.
I'm trying to think how our approach is going to be, okay, relative to the walking our friendly legislators through this. Being understand, one, the issue you're bringing up is why do we have these unfunded, I mean, the UDs, okay, because that is a big issue. 2003 was a big issue.
Yes, sir.
And then you're going to ask for this. Okay. Sorry, I'm thinking out loud.
I think that to continue with your comment, this slide that shows the funding, planning, design, construct, close laterally is a great slide because it shows the two biennium side by side and why that exists the way it does. It's easy to capture the concept in that slide.
Yeah. I think the key to me is education, particularly is like why the UB is a big chunk of, for example, is for another Texas.
Exactly.
It's a unique project type of situation. Remember, you've got lots of new members and you know, who's going to be the chairman of, you know, the new chairman, going to be a lot of new chairmen of these committees. We have our work cut out for us on this one. Boy, it's every 2 years you got to almost start all over again. As Gene and Scott know, and Carter knows from going through last week.
On slide 7, where you have the $10 million for development, by development, you're referring to the fund plan design segment of the horizontal bar?
What I'm talking about, sir, is there's a difference between repairs, which are repairing things that we already have. New development means building something that we don't have before. For example, group recreation facilities. We're doing one up in Palo Duro, but that's being funded by a donor. But it's to be able to do those kind of things, especially those things at state parks, new development that they think will bring in new revenue.
Anybody else have questions or comments?
I guess I have a comment. And maybe it's just the way the legislative system works, but this is the third session that I've actually been a commissioner with in, and is there any way we could avoid this, you know, re-instruction of the process? I mean, we spend so much time re-instructing all the legislatures about our spending process, and it doesn't, even with the senior members, it doesn't ever seem to carry to the next session. We always begin from sort of a zero point where we have to explain it, as if you're not here this morning. I mean, at some point it seems like the process would become common knowledge.
Yeah, you would think so, because this is the same process everybody has to do. So whether you're TxDOT or sales trying to build a restroom and they're trying to build $100 million highway, it's the same process. There's some that get it, and there's some that never get it, and I'm not trying to say that negatively or positively.
It's just a reality.
It's just a reality, and I'm like you. This is my fourth one, and of course, Gene's been through 100 of them.
Yeah.
So he just suggested.
Sorry, Gene.
Anyway, I'm in a positive. I guess every 2 years we play old.
You look good. We're looking
like Gene, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, it just was, as you are pointing out, I think you literally, the best way to go in as is if nobody understands it. So obviously, if you're sitting with Senator Ogden, you don't have to spend a lot of time going.
Yeah,
if you're sitting with somebody else, and even if somebody's been there, you know, and been, maybe even been on appropriations or been on Senate Finance or, you know, either side of the equation, sometimes you have to start all over again. And when they see UB, especially in a year like this, I mean, they just don't want to give you, I mean, they don't, they, not only don't want to give you anything new, they want to take that back. In fact, on the Devil's River deal, when I called Senator Ogden about it told him we had the $2.7 million that the member of the TPW was able to put in, you know, of course Dan and his group put in a lot of private money, he said, "I want that back." That's the first thing he said. Okay? I mean, he didn't want me to use that. I said, that's already appropriated for this. So my point being is, we all better be prepared. And remember, he said it's in finance. I mean, you know, he's probably the third or fourth most powerful guy up there. So. And, you know, we've built our credibility with him, but it's just a reality. It's going to be tough to get this 50.
Sure.
No, I don't know if that answers your question, Mark. I just think it is what it is, to use that term.
And the reason, I mean, I bring it up for Gene's benefit as much as anyone's, because he's had to bear the burden of this process longer than anyone. But and this probably goes beyond anything we're capable of addressing, because it goes beyond just this department. But it seems like a flaw in the system.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I don't disagree. And remember, there's going to be, in a buy any of them like this, there's going to be so much movement of dollars around. And I'm worried about the money up in Fort Worth. And I mean, you know, I mean, my guess is that, you know, a lot of money not going to be appropriated, and we're going to have to scramble to try to hold on to what we can hold on to actually be able to use it. That's going to be one of the big issues. Then see, but if they don't appropriate it, then, you know, they need it to offset deficit.
Okay, anybody else?
Reed. Well, the thing that jumps out at me, and I don't want to take up time here, but maybe you can educate me. It takes 24 months to fund, plan, and design. That seems like you'd be more ready to spend the money than to take 2 years to get started. Now, again, it may be the department, the way it works there, but I just, it's surprising.
Yes, sir. Part of the problem is that we do this backwards, or the legislature causes us to do this backwards. Normally, if you want to do a project, you're going to do the planning up front and then figure out how much it's going to cost you and do the funding. We end up doing it backwards. They ask us for a list of projects, and we do not have the money in which to do the investigation of the actual scope of the project. So after we get the funding, and it takes us a while to go through the hoops, usually up until April of the next year, to go through, you know, this commission, the Legislative Budget Board, Texas Public Finance Authority, and the Bond Review Board to get those approvals. Then we have to sit down and actually do the investigation, now that we have the money, into what the true scope of these projects are. Then we deal with the state procurement rules, and that ends up usually it's a 3 to 4 month, usually closer to 4 month process in order to get a designer on contract because of the state procurement process. And so then when you add that into putting out the proposal and the bids, that gets us close to the end of the second year, and then it's a 3 month process to get a general contractor on contract. So we usually are right on that border of the 2 years. But in the meantime, of course, the legislature's met, because they're meeting, you know, right now, and it's usually in the spring where we're actually finally getting all of the designs in and out to bid again. So the math is there somewhere. I'm not sure if I helped you with it. I'd be glad to.
That answer was coming.
What I had to do, so I don't know if you want to take a few minutes there tomorrow, maybe get with Rich and have him walk you through the process.
That's what I need to do.
Yes, sir. I'd be glad to do that.
I look at it and I say, if you got a leaking roof, it takes you 2 years to get it fixed.
Yes, exactly.
It doesn't make sense.
And it's whether you're building a $25,000 restroom on a park or a $100 million bridge, you know, in Dallas.
Now,
it doesn't make any difference. It'll drive you anyway. Yep. We've tried to do something. I think Scott and Rich walked you through it, shorten it somewhat relative to the regional contractors. At least in the past, the TPW, every project was separate contractor and all that. That's helped speed it up a little bit. There's just a certain element here that we have to, by law, do a certain way.
Let me just add one more thing for the commission in general, and that is, this is the generic timeline. Individual projects move at different speed. For example, engineering projects, wastewater projects, an engineer can do it very quickly, and then we're into construction. Other projects that require an architect, that require destruction and creating a whole new building or building a whole new building, those things take much longer, and it's keeping all of those things in the pipeline in hundreds of projects. We have right now over 200 projects going on. It's keeping all of those juggled and moving forward, which contribute to that time as well. So, again, this is a generic timeline. Some projects from the last session are already into construction. Others, we won't even get the design for another year or so.
But the chairman holds the point. Most of the time that's required is required because of the process that we're required to follow.
That's right, yes, sir.
I had the same question 2 years ago, so I think it's a good idea.
Well, you'd think the funds would be expended more on a bell curve, and you wouldn't end up with these QED, but obviously you do. So.
And sometimes there are outside factors like in the Battleship Texas project where we've got other...
Well, that's a whole different project.
So with that, I will move on to my last slide, which is slide number 9.
Marianne, we're going to just move that battleship right up and put it in your backyard. If it doesn't sink, the ship's going to go away.
And I will tell you, sir, that's our biggest concern is not sinking it in the ship channel.
Please don't do that. Don't do that on my watch. Wrecking railroads.
The rendering on this slide is from the schematic design package based upon the master plan for the State Historic Site of 2003. As you can see, the locations for the proposed visitor center, and of course the battleship is where the battleship is. First, the visitor center project. Some of you may recall we've been waiting for the last year for a decision by the Federal Highway Administration whether they were going to require us to do an environmental impact statement. In September, we received an answer from them that said that they have found no significant impact by the project. Therefore, we are continuing with the environmental assessment, which is due to be finished this coming summer. If at that time the determination is still that there is no significant impact, we will complete design in 2012 and construction the following year. On the Battleship Texas Dry Berth project, last fall we contracted the Houston office of AECOM, which is a worldwide architectural and engineering firm, to do the design. For the next couple of months, they will be doing their preliminary design. After that, we will use that preliminary design for cultural and environmental reviews, and then a series of public meetings to present those findings. If at that time the Department of the Navy determines that there is no significant impact by the project and we're not required to do an environmental impact statement, we will complete the design in 2015 and complete the project in 2017. And with that subject...
Has this been pushed back now 2 more years?
This is the latest timeline. I can't remember the last... It does continue to grow, yes, sir. But we're very confident now in this. I have not had a chance to talk to him, but the project manager for this project met in the last 2 days with Naval Sea Systems Command, and we've ironed out a lot of the issues involved with going forward with especially with the environmental assessment. So we've had good talks with them recently, and I think we're in a very positive position.
But is there no way to accelerate work on the ship versus the visitor center? I know that there are constraints on the visitor center that you've discussed. But.
Well, we are right now on schedule. It's a 2-year process to do this environmental assessment as required by federal law for this project. So that's the part we're in. So it's all part of the design is a two-year window to do that environmental assessment.
You're coming for the dry berth and you're coming for the visitor center now?
Dry berth.
The dry berth, no. I mean, why has that been held up?
At this point, it has not been held up. We've been moving posititively forward, really, for the last year. What the distractions have been the visitor center things, but at the same time, we've been continuing forward with the dry berth. And it's been getting a designer on contract and then beginning their preliminary design.
You don't think there's any way to move it any more quickly than what you just outlined?
At this point, no, sir. That's the timeline. We scrubbed that schedule, and that's where the schedule sits. And again, it's those requirements to meet the federal National Environmental Policy Act and the National Historic Preservation Act. It's that two-year window there.
Anybody else comments, questions? All right. Mr. Chairman, this committee has completed its business. Oh, sorry. We've got, beg your pardon, Mike Mendiola and Noe Cisneros on the
safety
program. Sorry. If I didn't mispronounce your name, forgive me.
No, sir, you get it right. Thank you. Thank you, Rich.
Good morning again, Commissioners. I'm Rich McMonagle, Director of the Infrastructure Division. Joining me are Mike Mendiola, the TPWD Safety Officer, and Noe Cisneros of Holt Cat. Over the last several months, the two of them have collaborated on a study of our safety program, and they're here to present those results. I think all of us here at TPWD appreciate Chairman Holt in lending Noe to us, his expertise and counsel, and even his acting as a role model for all of us on this has been invaluable in going forward. So I'll turn it over to Mike.
I appreciate it. Can I ask that one thing so the commissioners can understand kind of what this has been driven by? Was, of course, the accident that happened, and we're going to talk about that in a moment with our wildlife biologist on the tractor, on the machine. Also, deaths in the law enforcement side since I've been on this mission, and in my business, my personal business, which is the Caterpillar machinery business, heavy machinery, we also have a lot of safety issues, and we got way behind the curve in our my personal business, understood, learned, and Noe has been leading this over the last 3 years. It's you've got to create a whole kind of culture change, to use that term, in your organization. So first we wanted to, of course, review and see what the safety programs TPW had or did not have and that kind of thing, and then review the accidents and that kind of thing. And then want to eventually build a safety program that will be inherent at Texas Parks and Wildlife. And I can tell you it's a 3 to 5 year project. And so, very certainly, it wasn't Holt. And my belief in talking to others, you know, I can talk about that because we went around the country and, you know, learned a lot and spent a lot of time and brought in third party consultants and that kind of thing. Holt, I just thought we could get kind of leverage off of that at TPW. So, I just hate to see anybody hurt in any kind of accident that could have been prevented, maybe with either training or. Or some previous knowledge, or something that maybe we as a department should have done. And so I think we're on the right path. But I can tell you, it's another one of those things that just doesn't happen overnight.
Thank you, Chairman Holt, Chairman Duggan, and Commissioners. As Richard McMonagle stated, my name is Mike Mendiola. I'm the Agency Safety Officer for Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. This morning, I'll be presenting the recommendations of the West Luttrell Accident Review Board, as well as the recommendations for our safety program. West Luttrell was a wildlife biologist who worked at the Gus Engeling Wildlife Management Area. West grew up on a farm and had in Grayson County and had extensive experience operating tractors and heavy equipment. West tragically died in a tractor accident at the Gus Engeling Wildlife Management Area this past May. Shortly after the accident, we assembled an accident review board to analyze the accident based on the facts presented in the internal affairs investigation. The accident review board consisted of members of the Safety and Risk Management Committee as well as field staff. Ultimately, the accident review board concurred with the findings of the internal affairs report. Wes's death affected all of us here at TPWD, and going forward, our actions are going to be committed and relentless efforts to prevent future tragedies. The Accident Review Board had an opportunity to look closely at the accident and came up with these recommendations. The first recommendation is to develop and institutionalize a formal training program for operating tractors and heavy equipment. Currently, training is done ad hoc, and we want to formalize the training so that everyone receives the skills they need to work safely. We also found the need to enhance the standard operating procedure for operating tractors and heavy equipment. We have an SOP, but the board wanted to expand it to include things that were not mentioned, such as hydraulic equipment safety. As part of the Accident Review Board, we acted upon this recommendation and have since rewritten the SOP. We also wanted to establish minimum safety equipment requirements for tractors and heavy equipment to include seat belts and rollover protection. This recommendation was also included in the new SOP. The most profound observation, as Chairman Holt mentioned, made by the Accident Review Board was the need for change in our safety culture. Through discussions with the Accident Review Board and through Mr. Cisneros' assessment, we have determined the culture of TPWD is best characterized by a get-or-done attitude. Field staff feel they are driven by pressure to produce results over all other considerations, including safety. Safety is not given adequate consideration in budgeting and operations, and demands exceed resources, causing safety to be compromised. These factors combine lead to a deadly culture of complacency where safety is neglected. It's important to note that many of our sites are doing a good job in safety. This, however, is on their own initiative rather than being driven, being led from above and supported by all levels. During the process of our assessment, Noe Cisneros conducted interviews with deputy executive directors, division directors, site managers, park rangers, and other field staff. I accompanied Noe on these visits to state parks, wildlife management areas, and inland and coastal fish hatcheries. We also toured Holtcat in San Antonio and spoke to President and Chief Operations Officer Alan Archer and Vice President Ron Kraft, who shared examples of lessons learned and best practices. In collaboration with Noe, we have developed a number of recommendations for improving our safety culture, and those recommendations fall under these four categories. These categories are interdependent and equally important. The following slides will expound on each one of these. To engage leadership in safety, there must be accountability. We need to ensure that everyone in the agency understands management's commitment to safety and that measures are put in place to continuously monitor and enforce safety. Safety needs to be instilled as a core value. Regular communications between field staff, the safety program, and management will reinforce the commitment and accountability. We would also recommend the safety program report annually to the commission and quarterly to the executive management team. The next recommendation category involves organization within the agency. In order to effectively influence a safety culture, the organizational placement of the safety program is crucial. We recommend adequate staffing solely dedicated to the mission of fostering a superior safety culture. We recommend adequate budgeting for resources for the safety program as well as safety within the divisions. Adequate resources include the investment in personal protective equipment, communications, training, and recognition programs. When we make these necessary improvements, we will also be staying true to goal number 4 of the Land and Water Plan, which is employ efficient, sustainable, and sound business practices. The third recommendation category is awareness. It includes establishing an internal safety communications program and a unique identity and branding component. The internal communications piece will create an umbrella signature for all safety culture change activities, events, and communications. As part of our safety culture initiative, we are currently working with our communications division on a comprehensive communications plan. Safety Matters is the theme and logo that was created by Holtcat, and you'll see it on hats, posters, and bumper stickers wherever Holtcat products are sold. The next recommendation category relates to the processes that make this all happen. These pictures show the results of two accidents that occurred this past year in opposite ends of the state. No one was seriously injured, but this shows the importance of implementing the following processes. We recommend implementing an employee perception survey, which takes a cultural snapshot and quantifies where to best focus improvement efforts and build upon strengths. From there, we recommend forming continuous improvement teams. We recommend adopting a near-miss reporting system. Employees in need of immediate focus will learn accountability through coaching and realize at-risk behaviors by writing their own commitment statements. When utilized properly, these tools will allow for us to become proactive versus reactive as we are now. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Noe Cisneros to share some of his successes at HoldCat.
Thank you. First, Chairman Holm, thank you for the opportunity to work alongside of Texas Parks and Wildlife employees. It's been an honor and a pleasure to give my time to those who do an outstanding job of preserving our state parks and wildlife. And by the way, I have some good news. They've all persuaded me to become an outdoors man. Unfortunately, my entertainment room at home is now abandoned. Commissioners, Chairman Duggins, in 2006, HoldCat found itself in a situation where its safety management practices were inadequate. That was confirmed by our statistical information, which we internally compiled. But more importantly, it was confirmed by our outside customer. They were giving us some feedback. So as a result, we examined our safety management practices, and we discovered that the traditional centralized safety approach that included a safety representative, which was largely focused on reactive administration, compliance, and safety inspection processes, came up short. What we've learned since then is a safe work environment is the result of purposeful, effective influencing behavior and leadership. We acknowledge that safety begins and ends with every single individual in the company, beginning with the owners. We realized that safety needed to become HoldCat's way of life because it's the right thing to do, and in Peter Holt's own words, it was the ethically correct choice. So to that end, we added personnel to our safety department, which has led our efforts since then. It's led our organization in learning, integrating, adapting, and reinforcing safe work habits in the workplace so we can achieve a zero-accident workplace. HoldCat safety initiative began and continues to be a structured, strategic effort to guide the organization towards a world-class safety program. To that end, we have achieved a tremendous amount of success by doing the following. First, approaching our employees to help us brand our safety initiative. We've also practiced caution and sensitivity around our messaging pertaining to safety. It's amazing what kind of messages we can send, intentionally or, 9 times out of 10, unintentionally, through our omissions or our commissions. So we're a lot more cautious about what we say, what we focus on. Focusing on upstream activities versus downstream activities has gotten us a lot of gain. Sharing, and more importantly, celebrating success stories is another thing that we do. We gather, as Mike Mendiola mentioned earlier, we gather perceptions, employee perceptions, because that's their reality. And we use that to identify strengths and, more importantly, opportunities. By the way, we don't deal in problems, because when we talk about problems, what kind of emotion does that invoke? Pretty negative. Right? So we look at it as an opportunity. There are always gold nuggets to us. Engaging employees for ideas to address those same opportunities we identify through perception surveys is another practice that we have in place. And last but not least, we utilize a question-based approach to eliminate at-risk behavior. Our effort required, actually I would probably argue, that it demanded a change in attitude. To that end, we now, 4 years later, adhere to four basic rules of engagement. First one is overcome status quo. Reinforce what works. Make it a priority to learn quickly. And last but not least, be supportive of one another. Safety is never an opportunity to play the I gotcha game. It's not an opportunity to play the I catch a game or an opportunity to put a human through the most punitive process conceivable to man. Rather, it's an opportunity to show one another how much we care. And we take that seriously at HoldCat. And it's taken us, or brought us a long way. Today, HoldCat's journey continues. It's a relentless commitment that can never let up. Because the minute you do, it goes all down the drain. And as much as we've learned the last couple of years, one thing remains the same. I'm sorry to report, there is no silver bullet in safety. Another thing that we learned is that every organization evolves. We know that Holcat is not an exception to that. And so also to that end, we also developed a tactical approach that supports a thoughtful strategic outlook. And it consists of the following: integrating safety into daily work practices before, during, and after the job is done, reinforcing responsibility and accountability for safety, for safe work habits at the first line supervisory and job holder levels, learning from near miss incidents and unsafe practices, and last but not least, incorporating from this level throughout the organization safety language into our everyday languages and conversations and meetings. We've seen a lot of success, and folks, we did not get to a high frequency rate intentionally. Quite the opposite, unintentionally, we got there. We found ourselves focusing on other aspects of the business, and as a result, we took the focus off of safety. But we found that the minute that focus goes back on to safety, and that the message from the owners, the executives, is safety is valued just as much as all the other matrices in our organization, the behavior tends to shift. And I can prove it to you. I'd like to share some numbers with the group, if I may. In 2005, and by the way, I'm going to share with you what's called a workers' compensation experience modifier rate. Now, I can attempt to explain what that is, but I'll probably create a whole new science in doing so. So I'm going to water it down for my sake. What that comes down to is if you're at a 1, you're equal to others that do the same thing in your industry in terms of loss ratios. If you're below, you're doing far better than those in comparable businesses or the same SIC or NICS code. Is that helpful? Okay. That said, in 2005, we had a modifier rate of 1.35. That's when we started our effort, and we started communicating to the organization what the owners wanted and what their expectations were. In the following year, we went down to a 1.22. And then in 2007, we hit a 1.12. The previous year was 1.22. I hope I said that right. 2008, 0.94. The following year, 0.91. And I'm glad to report that this year we're at 0.79. It's been a steady decrease. Any questions, Commissioners? Chairman?
Oh, actually, you can't let up. Truly, it's got to come from the top, and like anything that you're trying to do is when you change an organization or try to focus on continuous improvement, which is what safety is all about, it's a never-ending process. That's why I wanted to get it started, and I've been here on the commission almost eight years, and we've lost two game wardens, this individual. We've had multiple accidents, of course, because I don't know how many vehicles we have on the road, how many tractors, 3,000-plus employees, you know, covering every inch of the state. Law enforcement, obviously, is in the business of dangerous business. So it's time, and I wish I'd focused on it, just like I wish at Holcat I'd done before people died and all of that. For me, this is very important, and I appreciate you guys being willing to take it on and get involved. And Colonel Flores, I know your group has started to make some changes also, is that correct?
Yeah. Okay, any other questions or comments?
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I just want to reinforce what was said. You hate the fact that it took something as sobering as Wes's loss to catapult us into looking at this so deeply, but I think Mike and Noe have done an extraordinary job of pointing out those areas that we absolutely have to improve. There is no doubt that the work of our agency is dangerous, but it doesn't have to be unsafe. And for the agency to aspire to a zero accident rate, folks can argue about the feasibility of that, but that's absolutely what we need to aspire to in terms of owing our colleagues and their families back home or expecting everybody to get home safely after a day's work for this organization. And so the recommendations that have come forward in terms of what is expected from leadership at the staff level with your support, the culture changes, and impressing on our colleagues the absolute criticality of making safety a part and parcel of every one of our activities, and carrying out our duties is absolutely imperative. And so I just want you to know how seriously we take this. We wanted you to hear these recommendations. We asked them not to pull any punches. I don't think they did. And so we've got our work cut out for us in terms of some changes, and look forward to coming back to you all and reporting on our progress.
In the meantime, who in the staff is primarily responsible for moving this forward as recommended?
And that's something we're going to be talking about at the executive leadership team immediately following this. You know, Mike is our chief safety officer. Historically, that program has reported through infrastructure. I think one of the strong recommendations from Mike and Noe and certainly Rich is that that needs to be elevated to make sure, again, that safety is given the highest look and priority inside the agency. And so we are going to be making some changes there in the very, very near future.
Thank you, Phyllis.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Before I turn it back to you, Mr. Chairman, I want to just say on behalf of the rest of us how much we appreciate your generosity and leadership here and loaning us some members of your company. And thanking y'all, Mr. Cisneros, for his time and efforts here. I think it's very gracious of you. Appreciate it very much.
With that, I'll turn it back. Okay, make sure you got a park pass. He bought his annual park pass. For his lifetime park. I appreciate that.
Okay, we've completed our business. Chairman Holt, turn it back to you.